Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. Our show might more accurately be described tonight as electrifying as opposed to riveting, since our subject is cybersecurity, and I think folks will really enjoy this. It will be cybersecurity like 101, and that subject is really in the news now under two big categories. One, the NSA, and the type of spying that they're doing not only on people that need to be spied on, but apparently ordinary citizens of the United States. And then, based on news released from the Congress today and congressional hearings, we have a real problem with cybersecurity and the Affordable Health Care Act, or what some call Obamacare. Four or five of the major security experts in the country have said it is 100% open for hacking. And these gentlemen are what you call white hackers. White hackers, that means that they hack and then tell you what they did and found out, and they do it for money now. They used to kind of do it for fun. And they're saying that this site is just, and it's worse than November when they first made the comments about that. Nothing has really changed. It's still like they use the term 100% open for hacking. So anyway, we'll talk about that and have a couple, one or at least one hacking story tonight. Thank you so much, Audrey, for getting us on the show tonight, and welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumbled Justice Radio Show. We kind of take a close-up look at criminal justice professionals and their work and what they do. Tonight would be a good example, as the speaker in front of Congress was from the FBI. His name is Sean Henry, and he will speak to us on cybercrime. He's the former executive assistant director for criminal and cybersecurity programs with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Emily, thank you for being here with us tonight. And Mike, thank you also for your technical support. And away we go. We told you what this show is going to be about tonight. It's going to run, the speaking will run about 43 minutes. I usually don't get through it all and tell you to go find it yourself. Hey, that's kind of promoting learning, right? But anyway, we dedicate this show to these tireless police, courts, corrections, juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and around the world. They don't all do a perfect job every time, every call, every case, but what would we do without them? And they are the best in the world here in the United States. And we have, local control, essentially, for our criminal justice agency. That's rare, and if non-existent, in other parts of the world. Okay, it's Blog Talk Radio, and if you haven't been to Blog Talk Radio before, every once in a while somebody joins us who never has before, you can get your own radio show. In about 3 minutes, you can be signed up and be broadcasting worldwide, all across the world to as many people who will pick up the radio show and listen, and it doesn't cost you a penny. If you're at prime time, I think that's 8-7. What is that, Mike? 8 to 10, something like that. If you're between 8 and 10, then you have to pay a little bit, but that's not much. But you have a midnight show, right? I think a lot of people have done those kind of things. So anyway, get your own show if you don't like this one. We told you what tonight's show is all about, and I think you will enjoy this. Like I said, this will be 101 in terms of cybersecurity, a course title. And I think you'll enjoy seeing all the different ways that people are vulnerable in corporations to this hacking business if they don't know it already. And who would know it all? Because it's changing minute by minute. As soon as you fix something, whatever, then they change things. Having been to Romania many times, some of the top cyber criminals in the world operate out of Eastern Europe and in Romania. And one of the things, one of the reasons for that is you have to be bright to be good at this. And the Romanians, when they graduate from school, guess what? They can all read and write and speak 3 or 4 languages. Isn't that amazing? And we're having trouble getting folks to speak one and write our own language. I'll talk more about NCAA athletics in a news story here later on. Well, Audrey has a blonde joke for us tonight, and she handed it to me since it's a short one. And I'll go ahead and do this blonde joke. And it says, why did the bomb tiptoe across the front of the medicine cabinet? Now, I know people would know the answer to that, right? Why did the bomb tiptoe across the front of the medicine cabinet? You're right. She didn't want to wake up the sleeping pills. Okay, that's a short one. We haven't done long ones in quite a while, but I think we'll let Lucy do some later on. We have a green tip for the night. Also, remember, ladies and gentlemen, we are trying to save this planet. And this one comes from, you wouldn't guess, Esma Floyd's little book called 1001 Ways to Save the Planet. And this is green tip number 955. And it says, use a swimming pool cover to reduce evaporation and therefore water loss. This can save more than half the water in your pool over a year's time. So if you're letting that pool sit out there with no cover on it, you are doing danger to our planet. Get yourself a swimming pool cover. Hey, this is going to be good. We're going to play the Ohio Coalition's warning against carrying firearms. I guess they're meaning everybody, not just criminals. Is that right, Mike? I keep asking you that, but 1,000 times we played this warning, but this is the Ohio Coalition against firearms, and they don't want you to carry any guns. But a very interesting news story has just broken today also, and that's this Harvey Weinstein, this movie producer, is going to make a movie. He hates the NRA, the National Rifle Association, the organization that protects your gun rights more than probably any other, although there's some others on the planet. And he's going to make one that's going to make, he says they'll wish they were dead or something along that after he makes this movie. And Meryl Streep's going to star in it. I think he's going to be surprised. But anyway, we'll have to follow that story as this movie comes out. And all these people that talk about this don't know anything about gun data, that's for sure. Okay, here we go. The Ohio Coalition Against Firearms doesn't want us to carry any. And here is their message to us.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Always wondered why they use the sound of guns to do that. I guess that fits in with the idea of guns. Gunfire is a deadly idea, but I wonder if they recall that 300,000 people a year, yes, 300,000 people a year, use a firearm to ward off a felon, and 7% of the time, 97% of the time, what do? They just pull the gun out and they the street crooks and the burglar in your house take off. So it works pretty good. Okay, let's take a look at some of the news stories. I'll try to be as brief as possible on these, but some of them are really interesting tonight and have consequences for us. Just mentioned to you that healthcare.gov, our new government website to get enrolled in the Affordable Care Program. Cybersecurity researchers today slammed healthcare.gov security during a House hearing, that's today, on Thursday, saying that the site is still riddled with problems that could put consumers' sensitive health details at risk. The reason we're concluding that is so shockingly bad is that the issue across the site are so varied. He said there are more problems than they could even count. You don't even have to hack into the system. This is a quote. You don't even have to hack into the system to see big issues, which means there are major problems underneath those. Isn't that incredible? And I wonder how many millions and billions. Wasn't the guy that kind of set this up, wasn't he the First Lady's college friend or something like that? Nothing wrong with hiring your friends if they know what to do. But only half of one of these 18 issues on healthcare.gov have been fixed since November when they were first brought up, and then there's new ones have been discovered. So absolutely incredible, and this is going to have consequences. He says Greg discussed concerns about healthcare.gov going up so fast. He said, you know, if you're building on a terrain that's not secure to start with, hacking is big business today. He also criticized Kennedy and Greg, some of them, for saying what he called speculation. This isn't speculation, ladies and gentlemen. You're going to be hearing about these things if they can get inside of it. But this whole thing is kind of sinking into a swamp, and we need to do something about that so people aren't hurt. All right, that's the healthcare.gov security issue. Executions have been going on. In Ohio, executed a man today. And what did he do? Well, the first thing in Ohio did, they used a two-drug cocktail. And remember, we had three drugs, and then the one drug became unavailable, and it was something which was obtained overseas in Europe, I believe. And then they went to the one drug, the one great big drug, and apparently that wasn't good enough. So now Ohio tried the two-drug thing and said, the condemned killer appeared to gasp several times during his prolonged execution. He made several loud snoring or snorting sounds. During more than 15 minutes, it appeared to take him to die. His stomach rose and fell several times as he repeatedly opened and shut his mouth. I would never want to go to an execution, but some people do and have. And, of course, family members and victims of crime, family members go to these kind of things. It's one of the longest executions Ohio has had since 1999. He was sentenced to die for the 1989 rape and fatal stabbing of a young pregnant woman. He acknowledged that he was responsible in a letter to John Kasich, our governor in the state of Ohio, last month. Ohio has never tried a lethal injection method was adopted. Ohio's never-tried lethal injection method was adopted after the maker of the state's previous drug put it off limits for capital punishment. Anyway, we're trying to figure out all these ways to execute people. And I saw here where Wyoming is bringing up, they want to get into their law, which I think, isn't it Nevada or Utah, I should know. Number one means of execution is a firing squad. Guess what? The firing squad always works. It always works. They end up dead, and it's near instant death, but we think it's brutal, so we don't want to do it. So everybody that represents somebody on death row to try to get the execution stopped says anything's brutal. That's what's happened in some of these other lethal injection processes. But anyway, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the death penalty. Here's another one. Oklahoma executes a man in a convenience store killing. I guess several people beat up this guy. I won't even go through the details, but he was convicted of first-degree murder. He's the third person executed for the February 25, 1995 crime. The fourth defendant is serving a life term. 95, 2005, 2000, this is 20 years this guy's been sitting around almost on death row, and they finally got around to getting him. One thing you can say about Oklahoma, is when they say you're going to get the death penalty in Oklahoma, you're going to get the death penalty. And when you get 5 years in prison or whatever, you will get 5 years in prison, not like Ohio. But anyway, they beat this guy up with an aluminum baseball bat, hit him 54 times, 100. Just absolutely sickening. So anyway, that's what's going on with that. I don't even want to talk about that, Mike. I can't believe. I don't want to talk about it. Here's a woman, cybersecurity. San Jose woman in California was bilked out of $500,000 by a Nigerian scam artist on a dating website that was ChristianMingle.com, of all places, ChristianMingle.com, and she luckily has recovered $200,000 from it. She's 66 years old. She met this guy on a dating website where he posed to be an Irish citizen working on a Scottish oil rig. Unfortunately, he was a Nigerian man who falsely claimed to be David Holmes. He used a picture he said was of him, was actually an image of a male model he downloaded from the internet. Oh, my. And this woman just about lost everything she had. She's lost $300,000. They said the chance of her getting this $200,000 back is almost. She was lucky getting that back, the $300,000. She says there's a 1%. They say there's a 1% chance of recovering the remaining amount of money. But unbelievable. And federal authorities do not get involved in losses below $1 million. Did you know that? I didn't know that. How did they pick that one? I mean, if I lost $500,000, it's every penny I got. Seems like maybe you could get involved in that and help us solve it. I got to check into that. That sounds really weird to me. Oh, here's another one that's good. Remember Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting? Everybody talked about it. Adam Lanza was the guy that did this. But the media hype about mass shootings in the United States has fostered a myth that the killings are on the rise and that an assault weapon ban, expanded background checks, and greater attention to the mentally ill will curb these things. Jim Fox, an outstanding criminologist at Northeastern University, says mass shootings have remained stagnant for 34 years, averaging 20 a year, and few were committed by the type of berserk psychos portrayed by the media. And a lot of these things are done with handguns. That doesn't make them right. He's got all the 10 myths, and I won't read you. Mass shootings are on the rise. They're not. Video games play a role. No link whatsoever. Profiling will help catch killers before they act. Absolutely not. They found that most are white and about 30 years old. Expanded background chance will stop the killers from getting guns. Absolutely not. An assault weapons ban would work. Again, they're not even being committed most of the time with an assault weapon. So that's not true either. So anyway, something to think about. We need to do something about it, of course, but some of the stuff we're doing doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I thought this was something else. Manchester University, not Monster University. That's a false one. Manchester University found a direct correlation between higher visits to religious places and lower crime rates. In other words, the more you go to church, the less likely you are to commit shoplifting, drug use, and music piracy. This was done in England, and there's some other studies that showed from a study in 26 years of data involving more than 140,000 people, that one said that nations that believe in heaven or hell had more crime. But they asked respondents about 8 varying types of delinquency, including littering, skipping school, using illegal drugs, fare dodging, shoplifting, music piracy, all that kind of stuff. Although the study found varying degrees of correlation between increased church visits and decreased crime rates, the most significant were seen in relation to shoplifting, illegal drugs, and music piracy. You mean to tell me going someplace where they promote and preach values based on a holy book would actually cause people to act better? Well, we always knew that, but I guess now, one more time, we can prove it. Here's an article about data thefts in Romania, but I'm not gonna go through that. Gangs are using social media. Let's skip that one too, Mike. How about that? I think that's probably enough on that stuff. I think what we're going to do now is go right to our speaker, and this is Sean Henry. Give me a little time to set this up, of course, and I think you're going to enjoy hearing him talk about Cybercrime 101 and then more in depth. And he'll talk about the various kinds of vulnerabilities that both people and corporations and government agencies have. And it's really entertaining if you know absolutely nothing about this, or even if you know something. Here we go.
Segment involving your money, we look at the FBI's role in fighting cyber crimes, and we're talking about cyber-based terrorism, espionage, computer intrusion, major cyber fraud, those types of issues. We're going to learn a little bit, and then we'll get to your calls, and we're going to learn a little bit first from Sean Henry, who from 2010 to 12 was the FBI's Executive Assistant Director for Criminal and Cyber Programs and the Bureau for quite a number of years, but thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
First, the question, the definition. Exactly what is a cybercrime?
Well, when you talk about cybercrime, I think you're talking about any type of criminal activity that involves the use of a computer. I think that's what most people talk about. When I talk about cybercrime, I'm really focusing on intrusions into computer networks. So those networks that we all use every single day, they increase our efficiency and our effectiveness and our productivity, but those very same things that make those networks so effective for us make them effective for cyber crime. People who jump into these computer networks, they exfiltrate data by the terabyte. They're stealing our intellectual property. They're stealing research and development, corporate secrets and strategies, personally identifiable information that they then use to make money. That's a huge, huge issue. It's something we need to be concerned about.
So we are talking about individuals, small business, corporations, government, the whole lot. How prevalent are cyber crimes these days?
It really runs the gamut from the smallest networks up to Fortune 500 companies, governments, educational facilities. I've said that there are two types of organizations, those that have been breached and those that don't yet know that they've been breached. And I can't tell you how many times when I was running the FBI's cyber program that our agents would show up to an organization, to a company, and tell them that their network had been breached because in the course of an unrelated investigation, we found their data.
Why don't they know when they're being breached?
It's a really complex issue. Oftentimes, it's not like when you come home from the movies and you find your television is gone, right? You know you've been robbed. The way data is exfiltrated from networks, the data is actually still there, but the adversaries copy that data and suck it out of the network, so you can't really tell that it's been missing. The other issue is that for many, many years, we've been focused on monitoring the perimeter of networks. That has been the kind of the mantra for computer security companies, that you need to look at your defensive posture and practice what we call defense in depth, having a firewall, an intrusion prevention system, using dual-factor authentication. But that's not working. And the most sophisticated adversaries are so clever and so capable that they're able to bypass those traditional defenses, and we don't even see them.
Phone number is on the bottom of the screen for our guest, Sean Henry. We have lines for Democrats and Republicans and independents. We're talking about the FBI's role in fighting cyber crimes. We'll get to that after one other question about the adversaries. Who are they, and where are they? What do you know about them?
Well, there really are a whole host of adversaries. I classify them into three groups. Criminal groups, which are made up primarily of organized crime elements. And these are very sophisticated organizations. Many of them are operating out of Eastern Europe. They are collaborating online. They gather virtually. In many of these cases, these groups, the individuals have never met each other. And they each have a very specific skill. They're able to target networks, primarily the financial services sector, retailers, et cetera. They're looking for personal information, usernames and passwords to other accounts, social security numbers, et cetera, and they can take that data and they can monetize it. There are also terrorist groups that have most recently become very public, calling for electronic jihad. and they've talked to their membership, their constituencies. These are folks that are sympathetic to the traditional jihadi cause, and they're looking to use cyber as a weapon to attack our critical infrastructure, our electrical power grid, our transportation system, etc. And then there are foreign intelligence services, and these are governments that are looking to steal government secrets, military strategies, but increasingly more so, they are attacking all of our major corporations, and they're stealing our intellectual property. They're stealing our research and development, and they're taking the data that they steal, and they're providing it to their home country's industries so that they can out-compete, maneuver us in a number of ways in the corporate environment and make their companies much more competitive against the United States.
So to the FBI, what is the FBI's role? Does it have the resources? And as somebody who is former FBI, what would you say about its success so far?
So I think the FBI, particularly in the last 5 years or so, has made significant strides. Let me say first that this really is the response in this area needs to be the government as well as the private sector. And when you're talking about the government, it's the whole government. It's the intelligence community, the Department of Defense, the FBI, DHS, et cetera. There are a whole host of government agencies. The FBI's role, the FBI, as you know, wears two hats. They have a criminal responsibility as well as a national security responsibility. And the FBI's role is really looking domestically to gather intelligence to mitigate the threat. And the FBI does that in a variety of ways, collecting intelligence, sharing it with others in government, sharing it with the private sector. The primary goal, really, trying to attribute who's conducting these attacks. Is it a criminal group? Is it a nation state? Is it a terrorist group? What are their motives? And what can we do as a government to try to mitigate that threat?
So how is the FBI performing, in your view?
I think the FBI is performing as well as it can under the circumstances. I've said that we're not winning the fight, although we've won many battles, but we're not winning long-term because the offense outpaces the defense, and the sophisticated adversaries are becoming more sophisticated. There are more groups, adversarial groups, that are getting online because of the value of the data. It's incredibly valuable, and because of that, many of these groups are moving their criminal enterprises. They're moving their espionage platforms to the network. So the breadth of the threat, the significance of it is getting wider, and I don't know that we're able to keep up in terms of capacity.
In terms of current resources in FBI cyber-related spending, this from fiscal year 2012, the numbers look like this. 2012 costs, $147.9 million. That funding supports 180 agents, and it supports electronic surveillance and digital forensics. There's a lot more to learn with our guest, Sean Henry, but let's get to calls first. Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Democratic line. Is it Golly or Jolly?
He is.
Go ahead.
My question is, with all the information that we just heard, is the Internet about to change as we know it today in a way that we can protect ourselves against this in the future?
I missed the first part of that.
Asking if the Internet as we know it is changing, can we prevent this in the future? Can we get ahead of this?
Yeah. So, I think this is such a broad threat, and I don't know that the average American ever gets to really hear about how substantial the threat is because much of these threats are really worked via or identified via the intelligence community, and they're not necessarily promoted throughout the private sector so that people get to see and hear about it. I think that what we need to do is change the focus. Again, not focusing on just playing perimeter defense, not trying to just protect ourselves, but we need to identify who the threat actors are, and I think we have to work to mitigate that threat, whether it be through policy, through some type of financial sanctions, diplomatic actions, and those sorts of things, particularly when we're talking about these nation states. We need to have a discussion. Because we are all at risk. This is not merely a U.S. problem. This is an international problem that we all face.
What's your sense of the economic damage that has been done already? And then speak to the security aspect of it, because this is a national security issue.
Yeah, no, it absolutely. President Obama said that this is the most significant economic and national security threat that we face. President Bush, prior to that, said that other than a weapon of mass destruction going off in one of our major cities, this is the most significant national security threat that we face. So certainly the government, based on all of its understanding, recognizes how substantial this is. There have been a number of consultancies that have tried to calculate what the cost of this is. The most recent one I saw was about $400 billion annually, which includes the cost to remediate the networks, lost productivity, lost intellectual property, et cetera. I don't really know how you quantify this. Again, it's so vast, and much of it is unreported. Companies oftentimes are reluctant to talk about the fact that they've been breached because they're concerned that it might impact their stock price. It might impact the credibility they have with their clients and customers. They may lose trust in their ability to protect the networks. I think, quite frankly, that companies should be more forthcoming, because this is happening to everybody. And companies, to think that, you know, we don't want to talk about this because this is going to make us look bad in the eyes of our customers. The fact of the matter is, it's happening to everybody. And I think that when we come forward, we start to talk about this in a much more public forum. We raise the awareness, we can start to put pressure on those that are causing these threats. Let's hear from Marion, Ohio now, Republican named Rich, along with Sean Henry, formerly with the FBI. Hi.
Yeah, how you doing? It seems to me we have some things we can get solved really fast, like the general on his email, Joe the Plumber, for his Social Security number and information like that. It seems like every device we have, atomic energy or none, has pluses and minuses. It's how you use it. I think because our Social Security number should only be used for Social Security, it's giving people around the world good ways to track us. And I can't understand how the government can't get on China. This has been going on for years, and they just can't get on top of it. If they can get on top of generals that are winning wars, I'll hang up.
So, again, I think that this really comes down to a whole of government response, that the technology is really just a piece of the answer here. You need to have technology on your networks to help identify when there's a breach, to give you much greater understanding about what's happening on your networks, to look for these intrusions and these incursions into your network. But that is a piece of the solution. And part of it, as the call said, is really having the discussions with nations that are aggressively pursuing this. There are dozens of countries who have these electronic espionage capabilities in place. They've got specific programs where they're targeting Western networks to exfiltrate data to empower their private sector, to empower their manufacturing base, their retail base, their research and development programs, and they're doing it at the expense of the American taxpayer.
Where is Congress on the cybersecurity legislation? Who's been hearing about it?
You know, there are more than 40 bills right now that are on the Hill, covering a whole range of cybersecurity issues. Some of these bills have been bouncing around for 5 years or more, and I recognize and understand it's an incredibly complex issue. There are a lot of different concerns that people have, whether it be the private sector, privacy groups, those in the government, and each has a different agenda or perspective. I think it's we have to have a greater sense of urgency here, because the threat is so significant. I've said that this is an existential threat, that this is a threat to life. If our critical infrastructure goes down, imagine, if you will, you know, I grew up in the Northeast, up in New York. I've got friends and family who are still suffering from this hurricane, Sandy. Imagine, if you will, similarly, where a major urban area loses its power for not just 7 days, 10 days, 14 days, but 7 weeks, 7 months. If the attack is so vast and so damaging that we lose the infrastructure where the equipment is destroyed and can't be replaced. These are some of the threats that we've talked about in the government. These are some of the things our adversaries have talked about doing to us, and it's something that we have to certainly raise awareness and take seriously and do so expeditiously.
I should point out, our guest is currently president of a company called CrowdStrike Services. It's a tech security company to assist companies in making their own networks secure. Why did you make the transition out of government, out of the FBI, into private?
That's a great question. I enjoyed my time in the FBI, tremendously proud of the people I worked with and the mission that I was involved with every single day. I was eligible to retire when folks at CrowdStrike came and talked to me. And while I had some other opportunities to do some things in Fortune 500 companies, I chose to go to a small startup company because of the vision they had, where they were focused on identifying and mitigating the threat, not just the standard run-of-the-mill, let's play perimeter defense, let's build a new antivirus product and deploy it on a network. The vision was that we have to have a paradigm shift in the way that we address this threat. And seeing what I saw in the FBI, seeing what I saw across the U.S. government, both not only from an operational perspective, but from a policy and strategic perspective, I recognized we had to change the way we do this. And I wanted to stay in this mission. I wanted to stay in this fight. And doing so with CrowdStrike was an opportunity to really bring my experience to a group of folks who have just a tremendous vision and want to change the way we do this. Let's hear from Mark in Manistee, Michigan, independent caller for Sean Henry. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Good morning. Good
morning.
Mr. Henry, my question has to do with the drone that we lost in the Mideast, where they apparently tricked it into landing in their country against our wishes. How much technology did we lose there? How's the investigation going on that issue? And I think that those drones should have some sort of a self-destruct, that if they do happen to, loss of control occur, that you can burn up all the relevant circuitry in that's high-tech and needs to be kept secret.
Yeah, so I don't have specific information about that particular case, but what the caller raises, I think, if in fact there was some intrusion into a computer network that may have controlled that piece of military equipment, I have no knowledge at all of that particular case. But all of our networks are connected, and the vulnerability is such that if an adversary is able to access a network, they can make changes to what equipment does. So one of the threats I talked about, these terrorist groups that are looking at targeting our infrastructure, they're looking at SCADA systems, industrial control systems, and these are the computers that control the big equipment that powers our infrastructure. If those computers are infiltrated, data is changed, that equipment is destroyed or altered, that equipment will cease to function the way it's intended to function, causing grave damage.
Let's hear from Linda in Knoxville, Tennessee. Linda's a Democrat for Sean Henry. Good morning.
Morning. My qualification for commenting on this is that I have been originally an ARPANET user, then more laterally an Internet user since 1976. My question is, what role has the successful effort by seminal low-level operating system companies, most particularly Microsoft, had at getting laws passed that give them no legal liability when flaws in their software open up gaping holes for intrusion?
I don't know specifically what Microsoft's lobbying process is. I think that companies need to understand the impact of their products on the private sector. I know many companies in the software world who have worked very diligently to close gaps in their product as it relates to security. I know that they've worked with law enforcement and others to understand what those threats are so that they can be more aggressive and more robust in their capabilities.
Take us back into the work of the FBI itself. Does it have the know-how to combat this problem the way that you think it should?
The FBI has made tremendous strides in hiring. When I started in the cyber side, we looked for good investigators and tried to teach them how to be technologists. We made a big change in that, recognizing that it was much easier to take a sophisticated technologist and turn them into an investigator. So when I was in the Bureau, we made great strides in hiring and recruiting out of some of the best technical schools universities in the country, people who have spent 10 years as systems administrators, computer scientists, and then as a second career brought them into the FBI. And with those skills, them very clearly understanding what technology is being breached and how to better track the adversary, we turn them into good investigators who are able to get a good sight picture on who our adversaries are working with others in the community.
That being said, what's missing as far as the FBI approach?
I think the capacity, just in terms of the resources. The FBI, again, is one piece of the solution. This is a whole of government response. The FBI's role being investigations domestically against criminal enterprises, against foreign intelligence services, trying to identify who the adversaries are so that some action can be taken, whatever it may be. But again, as I said earlier, I've yet to come across a network that has not been breached in my time in the Bureau and in the private sector with CrowdStrike. It really is capacity. The FBI does not have the ability to respond to each and every threat in this country.
What does the FBI have and not have access to when it goes to investigate a cybercrime against a person, a business, whatever it is it's looking into?
So when there's a breach into a computer network, there's a couple of things that need to be asked, not unlike your traditional crime.
Mm-hmm.
What happened? Why did it happen? Who did it? And that's a very, very key important point, is you've got to understand who actually caused the breach so you can take some sanctions, some actions against them. So when the FBI responds, not unlike a traditional crime where you're looking for fingerprints or you're looking for shell casings, you're looking for clues. In working in coordination with the private sector, the victim, you can look at the network, you can look at logs that indicate when somebody may have made access, you look at logs that identify changes that have been made in the network that give you the clues, like the fingerprints or the shell casings, that help to identify and attribute who the actors are.
Let's hear from Aiken, South Carolina now. It's Owen on the Republican line for Sean Henry. Good morning.
Yes, is the recent hacking in South Carolina a threat to national security? And what is the FBI's role, or if there is one?
So the recent hacking in South Carolina, I think the question was it related to national security? I don't have specifics on that particular case. My understanding from what I've read is that it was theft of personally identifiable information, which typically indicates an organized crime group. You're looking at these groups that are stealing data that they can then turn around and monetize and turn into actual hard cash. And when we're looking at Social Security numbers and the like, that's indicative of an organized crime group. Now, that being said, that's not necessarily 100% true. There could certainly be some national security aspect. Sometimes an adversary, when they have access to a network, they use it as a launch point for to attack other networks, or there may be some nefarious acts ongoing or other information that's been touched or stolen that we haven't yet seen.
We have Josh from Stillwell, Oklahoma now, independent caller. Good morning.
Hello. I have two statements real quick. On the Internet, isn't it true that they recently, just in the last two or three days, didn't Obama sign an executive order that would eventually turn over the Internet to the NSA and to the United Nations? And
Let me stop you there. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, so there's been discussion about an executive order being signed that might fill a void related to the legislation that has not yet been approved up on the Hill. So this administration has put forth legislative proposals that would allow for better information sharing, that would allow for harsher penalties for those who have breached networks. And the executive order going forward appears to look to fill that gap and narrow that void.
Will that be effective?
You know, again, this is such a huge, complex problem. There certainly are pieces. I think as it relates to information sharing, intelligence sharing, which allows us to get a much better understanding of what's occurring. These threats are so broad and diverse that when you look at just a little piece of them, you just do not have a picture of what's happening, about who the adversaries are, what other networks they may be targeting, and you're not able to pick up the indicators that allow you to actually identify them with any specificity.
My father was a New York City police detective for a long time, and he said that if you rob one bank, probably get away with it. The guys that get caught are the ones that rob 5 banks, 15 banks, 20 banks, and that's where they get caught, because along the way, they make mistakes, they make errors. I see this in a similar way, where if you're able to get a much broader understanding across a large data set, and you look at a volume of information or intelligence, you're able to really start to attribute what's happening. And when we talk about intelligence sharing, that's absolutely what occurs in that space.
So we had a second comment or question from that caller. Go ahead.
You still there?
I'm still.
Yeah.
Okay. I had my second comment was for the previous caller on energy and gasoline and things like that. Since the 80s, we've had the technology to run water through our engines. Stanley Meyer perfected it back in the 80s. I don't know whatever happened to that. He had numerous patents on it. He even proved it. YouTube has most of his information, even most of the technology on it. And also, we have the Geek Fuel Processor by Paul Pentum, and we also have the SEG generator that was developed by a man from Europe. He's still alive. His name is John Cyril.
I'm going to let you go and move back to the topic of cyber crime here with our guest, Sean Henry, formerly with the FBI. Let's hear from Arnie now, Van Nuys, California, Democrat. Hi, Arnie.
Good morning. My wife and I are both rightfully concerned about identity theft, and especially as it occurs over the Internet. My basic question is, do any of these products that we see advertised on television and or talk radio, there's one prominent one that starts with the letter L, and my wife knows about it. She wants me to sign up for $160 a year that will protect us from identity theft over the computer. Are any of these products effective?
So it sounds like what you're talking about, one of these services that identifies when your private information may have been breached or stolen and protects you in terms of dealing with creditors or attorneys and the like. Those are may or may not be successful. I think the fact that you're monitored and identified or you're notified is helpful and of value. But I think what we want to do is look to prevent rather than merely react to the issue. And I think that in CrowdStrike, for example, trying to identify who the threats are, the adversaries, and trying to stop them from attacking our networks, again, one of the strategies I think the U.S. government can use in a better way. So not merely in a reactive position, but in a proactive, in a much more offensive and strategic position. One of your wants to know a little bit more about the structure within the FBI. What role does FBI counterintelligence have in assisting the cyber crime division in identifying, assessing, and eliminating threats? That's a great question. So the FBI cyber division and counterintelligence divisions work very, very closely. Quite frankly, the threat that we're talking about from foreign intelligence services is a counterintelligence responsibility, and they're using the cyber as a weapon or as a vector. Many of the same things that have been occurring for thousands of years, people have snuck in under a tent and walked out with a papyrus with the secret plans on it. Fast forward to the current day, and we're merely using the networks as a vector into organizations to steal data. So the counterintelligence division and the cyber division in the FBI work hand in hand. Counterintelligence division bringing the expertise of how to deal with foreign intelligence services, understanding their tactics and their methodologies. The cyber division, from a technical perspective, bringing their capabilities, and together working in a coordinated fashion, having a much greater impact on the adversary.
By the way, here is that recent Washington Post piece on the executive order. Obama signed secret directive, is what the headline says, to help thwart cyber attacks, from Ellen Nakashima, The Post. This was published last week, dating back to mid-October, they say, the action took place. And they write that the president has signed a secret directive that effectively enables the military to act more aggressively to thwart cyber attacks on the nation's web of government and private computer networks. They're calling it Presidential Policy Directive 20, establishing a broad and strict set of standards to guide the operations of federal agencies in confronting threats in cyberspace. That's according to several officials. Anything else you want to add to that?
Said it's a secret order. Let's move on to Mike, St. Petersburg, Florida, Republican.
Michael Brennan, St. Petersburg.
Mm-hmm.
What you're just speaking to, the First Amendment has been lost in the quest for security, supposedly, and nobody really knows what the real motivation is. The country has gone down a path where we can't believe any of you, including this gentleman, today.
What do you make of that sentiment, that he can't trust me? I think there are a lot of real patriots in the U.S. government who have worked hard and made a lot of personal sacrifice to make this country safer. I think that people need to understand what the threat is, and if they understood what the threat is, what the threat is day-to-day, they'd be much more receptive to the investigative tactics and needs. I look at 9/11. If you can imagine August of 2001, if somebody in the government came forward and said, in August of 2001, when you go to the airport, there's a big threat from people who are going to try and blow up planes. You need to take off your shoes. You need to take your toiletries and put them in a little plastic bag. Take off your jacket. Take your laptop out of its case. People would have been up in arms. Right, we can't do this. This is an invasion of our privacy. Absolutely not. We're not going to allow it. It's inconvenient. And you fast forward, and planes crash into buildings, and all of a sudden people understand what the threat is. Now this is a problem. And now taking off my shoes is an inconvenience, but I understand and I get it. I don't really want to do it, but I understand what the risk is, and I'm willing to make these concessions in order to be safer. I see in the cyber environment the same. We're in the same place. Something really bad is going to happen. The digital equivalent of planes flying into buildings is going to happen, and people are going to be then asking, why aren't we doing something about this? Why haven't we done anything about it? And I think that the caller and others need to educate themselves and really get a better understanding. To address one other point, because this is really important, for 24 years as an FBI agent, I fought to protect people's civil liberties. I believe in freedom of speech. I believe in the U.S. Constitution. I swore an oath to protect it, as did many of the colleagues that I worked with. I take umbrage with somebody questioning and challenging patriotism and the willingness to die for the Constitution of the United States of America. Let's go on to Glens Falls, New York now. Richard, independent for Sean Henry.
Good morning.
Morning.
I believe there is cyber crime, but most of the people that are pushing it have a financial interest in the subject, and that always leaves me with a little bit of skepticism. In other words, I'm agreeing a little bit with the previous caller. I'm not calling you not a patriot, I'm not saying you're not a patriot, I'm just saying that the actual degree and sophistication of cybercrime, I think, still remains to be discovered. My question to you is that you've been talking about cybercrime as going in one direction only, an attack on the United States. But I think you have to also mention that the United States also participates in cybercrime, probably in the three divisions that you mentioned. There's probably corporate cybercrime against other nations in the country, in the world. And of course, we know that the United States government did some cybercrime against a nuclear reactor of another nation. So I think you ought to mention that also. Thank you.
Sean Henry. So the first point regarding, you know, people who are looking to make money off of this, I think that I'd ask the caller and others to look at the people who are actually talking about this every single day. General Michael Hayden, former head of the CIA, former head of the NSA. Admiral Mike McConnell, former head of the NSA, former director of national intelligence. General Alexander, current head of the NSA. Sean Henry, former executive assistant director of the FBI, people who have seen this threat from a very different perspective. They haven't looked just merely at the headline that somebody lost 50,000 usernames and passwords, or somebody stole $2,500 out of my account. What they've seen in their day-to-day life is threats on critical infrastructure, attacks on U.S. commercial space, military networks, government networks. They've seen it every single day. I've been talking about this while I was in the FBI for many, many years, and you can look me up at things that I've said for years, and what I'm saying now tracks, having no idea at all that I would move at some point into this space. But it goes to your question earlier, why would I move into the space? I moved into the space because I see that there's a problem that needs to be fixed. That's why I moved into the space. I didn't move into the space and then try to promote it, hoping that I would make a dollar off of it. But I want people to understand that this threat is absolutely real.
We're down to our last couple minutes here. Boston, next call, Democrat Doug for Mr. Henry. Good morning.
Oh, hi. Yeah, your guest divided the last caller's question. From the Iranian perspective, the greatest cyber terrorist out there are the United States and Israel. That may or may not be the case, but I would like to remind you that it was the United States that fired the first shot when it launched the Stuxnet virus against nuclear, obviously a really dangerous situation. And perhaps you didn't think they were going to respond. If that's the case, you shouldn't be in the job you're in. Anyway, have a nice day.
Anything you want to respond to there? I don't know what the question was.
Let's hear from Mike in Dover, Ohio, independent caller. Mike, got a question, comment?
Good morning. I'm fascinated on how many people are against the Cybersecurity Act. Why would the government have to tell you to lock your front door and close your windows at night to keep people from breaking in? And if you lived in a neighborhood where there was a large number of these, it just makes common sense that the neighbors would get together and ask or tell each other about the different methods that were being used, not what you have in your house, where you've got it hidden or anything else. That's immaterial. If you run a business and you're not going to lock your front gate, you're not going to lock the doors or your file cabinets or anything like that, you're an idiot, just a plain idiot. And why the government should even have to tell you that? If you had the Hope Diamond on display in your jewelry store.
Well, that's about all the time we have. I think Mr. Henry gave us a good introduction, 101 course on cybersecurity problems. And this was dated just about over a year. So we're going to hear more and more about this. And one of the things that we fear, the equivalent of 9/11, the electrical equivalent of 9/11, would be some great big power grid going down that would leave a substantial portion of the United States without power. And I think we'd probably be more concerned about this at the point. But these individual threats from people are important too. So that's it for tonight. Join us next week. We'll have some subject on Air Force, and we're going to ask Vera Lynn to sign us off with her song, We'll Meet Again.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.